All right, welcome everybody. The Yeshiva University Student Medical Ethics Society is a student-run organization with the goal of promoting education and awareness of medical ethics at Yeshiva University. MES, or the Medical Ethics Society, is especially focused on issues of medical ethics relating to halacha, Jewish medical ethics, and Torah values. Up to this point, we have run strictly on-campus events, raising awareness and increasing sensitivity to ethical issues in medicine that are relevant to the global community within the YU community. We run on-campus events all year long, most notably our annual conference that takes place around Sukkot. It's never early to pitch, so we'd love if everybody could come this upcoming Sukkot. You know, God willing, we'll be having another conference. Speaking of events, there will be a panel, I believe it's this upcoming Tuesday, I don't remember the details. There's a bulletin board outside. Titled To Tell or Not to Tell, Issues Relating to Family Health and Genetics. It's a panel discussion that is going to be bringing in Rav Yaakov Neuberger, Mrs. Mindy Eisenman, and Ms. Hani Weissman. So the Medical Ethics Society has been blessed to have grown to a point where we're able to start raising awareness outside of the YU community. We are proud to present our first off-campus event, Ethics of a Changing Body, Halachic Perspectives on Elective Plastic Surgery. Today's panel will be moderated by Rabbi Dr. Aaron Glatt. Rabbi Dr. Glatt is the assistant rabbi at the Congregation Anshei Chesed in Hewlett and right here at the Young Girls of Woodmere. After graduating class valedictorian of Yeshiva University, Rabbi Glatt received his MD from Columbia University. He is board certified in internal medicine and infectious diseases and the author of over 200 articles, book chapters, and abstract presentations. Rabbi Dr. Glatt was formerly president and CEO of the St. Joseph Hospital in Bethpage, New York. He is currently Executive Vice President and Chief Administrative Officer at Mercy Medical Center in Rockville Center, New York, as well as the full professor and former Associate Dean at New York Medical College. It's with great pleasure that I introduce Rabbi Dr. Aaron Glatt.
Thank you all very, very much for coming here today. This is a very important subject. It's always wonderful when people take time off from their busy days and use vacation time, a Sunday, to sit and learn Torah, and we are privileged to be co-hosting this with the Ethics Society at Yeshiva University, which is a wonderful group of young students. I've had the pleasure of working with them on a number of events. Truly a group to be admired, a group that has taken this very seriously, and kol hakavod to them for bringing such events to both the Yeshiva University campus, as well as now to our shul. Bishus Amar Da'asar of Bilit Shlita, it's a tremendous pleasure and honor for me to be able to host this event. I'll just open up with some very brief comments. Why are we having such an event? So obviously, plastic surgery, the idea to make yourself young and look beautiful, is something that is a very prevalent custom and is very important in social United States of America circa 2012. Everybody wants to look younger. Pons de Leon, the fountain of youth, still exists. Everybody wishes that they looked like they were 20, which happens to be Keneged the Torah's approach. The Hadras Panim, the white beard, Baruch Hashem I'm Zochet to have, is a beautiful thing. It's not something that a person should be ashamed of. In fact, that's something that we look forward to having. There are many people that aren't zochet to grow old. So many kiddoshim that died at a young age. So it's a zechus for a Jewish person to look their age, which is keneged the popular approach. Nevertheless, I don't think there's any place in the Torah that says that there's a mitzvah to look old. And we have, of course, from early on, we have Avram Avinu requesting that people should look old. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu says that's a good idea. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu changed it around, that people should age, that people should grow older, so that you could give the proper cover to an older person. Nevertheless, there is an entire industry, there's an entire specialty branch of medicine, in fact, there are many subspecialty branches of medicine that deal with trying to change the appearance of a person. Sometimes this is certainly, without even a shaila within the realm of halacha, if a person has injury or illness that is dangerous, is life-threatening, or limb-threatening, so certainly such surgeries, there's no shaila that they're permissible, even if they also serve a cosmetic purpose. And this symposium today won't really touch upon the things that are clearly and obviously permissible within halacha. But there are many areas within medicine today where various procedures can be done that don't serve any purpose purely from a life-saving point of view, and don't necessarily have any halachic permission implied through Rapo Yirape, that we have permission from HaKadosh Baruch Hu to go and heal people, because there isn't necessarily something that from a pure halachic point of view automatically fits into the category of permissibility. But does that mean that everything else is aser? Certainly not. And we're blessed today to have a panel of people who are very, very much involved in this, both from the medical point of view, and of course I'll have an opportunity to introduce Herschel Schechter Schlita later on, who certainly is a posek of worldwide renown and a person who it is a true privilege and zuchus for our shul to have. The outline for the program today is follows. We'll have our esteemed plastic surgeons give us a brief introduction into the field of plastic surgery, and then each of them will in turn present cases to our Rav Schechter that they have come up with from their own personal experience and practice that will be, I think, very helpful to elucidate the halachic issues that are involved with plastic surgery at this time. So it's my pleasure to call upon our first speaker, Dr. Marty Kessler, who is a well-known and skilled plastic surgeon who practices in our community. He is certified by the American Board of Plastic Surgery and has an additional credential from the Board of Plastic Surgery with a certificate of additional qualification in surgery of the hand. He is the co-founder of the Plastic Surgery Group PC, located in Great Neck and Rockville Center. He's a member of the Mercy Medical staff. We're proud to have him on our staff, as well as a member as well on the staff of some other local hospitals, not to be, of course, mentioned today. He's authored numerous scientific papers, book chapters, and presented multiple times at national and international meetings. He's an associate clinical professor of plastic surgery at Weill Cornell Medical College in New York City, and is mentioned in Castle Connolly as being one of America's top doctors. He graduated from the City University of New York, cum laude, and he received his medical degree from Cornell University Medical College. He completed his training at New York Hospital Cornell Medical Center and at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York City, and it truly is a pleasure for him to be a member of our shul, to be a chaver tov, and without any further ado, it's my pleasure to call up Dr. Marty Kessler to introduce the subject and to present the first case for Rav Schechter.
Rabbi Gratt, one thing I'd like to say is I'm proud of my gray hair as well, and also proud of the lack of hair that I have. So if you noticed, I've never changed any of those things, never considered doing it. I usually open all my seminars in most talks with people that are of a lay population with a question to the group, so I'll start it with a question. Does anybody know why I am called a plastic surgeon? Anybody have any idea why I'm called a plastic surgeon? Obviously, I'm not made of plastic, so that's not the reason. So, anybody have any concept of that at all? Well, if you look at the title of the talk today, it says Ethics of a Changing Body. Actually, I mentioned to the students that organized this when I came in today, I noticed when I was preparing for this last night that the title's a little incorrect. It shouldn't be Ethics of a Changing Body. It should really be Ethics of Changing a Body, because Ethics of a Changing Body would mean that are there ethics as our body changes? Well, we all know that our bodies change. I mean, that's what happens. That's why this whole talk is being presented, because as we change, people want to go ahead and have things done either to stop that process of change, or if it changes for reasons that are traumatic or other reasons, then it has to be changed for them. And that's where plastic comes from. If you know the word plastic, when you think of the word, when somebody uses the word plastic, that somebody has a plastic personality, or you look at the material plastic, it's because it's changeable or it's malleable. It actually comes from the Greek root of the word plastikos. Plastikos is actually a Greek word, which means to change something. So we are the surgeons that change people. We change their physical form. We treat all kind of problems, as I was saying before. We treat all kind of physical disfigurements, body image problems, body defects. These include post-traumatic problems, whether they're burns or people in car accidents or injuries. We take care of people's congenital deformities. People quite aware of those. Children, unfortunately, born with cleft lips, cleft palates, hand deformities. It's all part of our specialty. We take care of what's called, for the pre-medical students, iatrogenic problems. That means problems caused by other doctors, which would include physical deformities from cancer operations. Probably the most familiar that we deal with is breast reconstruction, which I think there's no question in anybody's mind. I don't know whether it will come to the topic today, but I don't think there's any ever halachic denial of a woman who has breast surgery having to have her breast reconstructed. I think what the topic's really going to key in today on is the cosmetic aspects of her specialty. That is what Rabbi Glatt said before. What if someone comes to me and says, something about me bothers me because I don't like the way I look. There's some disfigurement I have, and I don't like it. Can you do something for me, Dr. Kessler? I think also there's a distinction when it comes to halacha, and I hope Rabbi Schachter touches on that as well, is whether if the problem is emergent or elective. I think there's certainly certain emergent things that halacha clearly allows us to do, and some elective things that there may be some problems with. There are definitely, though, I know as an Orthodox Jewish plastic surgeon, some areas of conflict between halacha and plastic surgery. I mean, it's basically because since halacha affects every aspect of our lives, it definitely is going to have an interplay between the surgeon and his Orthodox Jewish patient. We know that basically the halacha is a Jew may not wound or mutilate his own body, nor endanger himself unless it is to improve some illness. If the patient has no impairment of function, pain, or any life-threatening danger, then is he not permitted, to cause the smallest bodily injury, which I'm going to do as a surgeon, I'm going to cause some bodily injury on the patient. Obviously, I do a lot of this work, and for myself, I found reasons that are appropriate and why I can do it, and I do operate on many Orthodox Jews, and I am myself interested in hearing a lot of Rabbi Schachter has to say. So I will start with my first case, as is told. I'm going to make up a scenario. I'm trying to bring in some controversial issues in the case, which either help make it easy to define as a case that's halakhically permissible or not halakhically permissible. First situation. I have a 48-year-old female of normal weight who's otherwise healthy, in very good physical condition, comes into my office complaining of marked laxity, or that means looseness, to her upper arms. She says as she walks, they sway back and forth. It makes her feel like her bubby. She remembers her bubby walking around that way, and she doesn't like it. It makes her unhappy. And in fact, she tells me her husband's not happy with it either. Her husband says to her, honey, why can't you do something about that? He finds it somewhat unattractive. She's also, since she's there, she says to me, by the way, while I'm complaining of this, I'm also noticing, also in my family, because my arms are a familial problem, I have my face is starting to age on me. Particularly around my neck, it's beginning to get loose, and I'm only 48, and my jowls are starting to show. Her husband tells her also at times, if you're going to go to the plastic surgeon, why don't you take care of this thing as well? After my examination, I determined that if she's going to have something surgical, it's best that she undergo two procedures. Something called a brachioplasty, again for the medical students, pre-medical students, that's a arm lift, brachial for arm, and something called a rhytidectomy, something that is a facelift, a lift of the face. So I will tell you briefly what that will entail, which is what Rabbi Glatt asked me to do, without understanding we're going to go into major details, but both operations will require me to take this patient to an operating room, put her under general anesthesia for approximately 6 to 6.5 hours, okay? She's going to have incisions put on both arms that run the length of her arms from her armpit down to below her elbow. I'm going to give you little technical aspects of it. In her facial procedure, she's going to have incisions going from her temporal hairline, around her ears, behind her ears, into the back of her neck. She's going to undergo a procedure where she will require to go into a recovery room for about 2 to 3 hours. She will require, because it's usually done in the office, an overnight nurse to take care of her for the first 24 hours. And she's going to go home really wrapped up like a Q-tip. Large dressing around her face, large bandages around her arms, drains coming out of her neck to take care of blood that comes out of the neck, and drains coming out of the arm. And she's going to come back and see me a few days later, and over the next 2 weeks, we're going to be seeing each other very frequently, probably 2, maybe even 3 times a week, to go through the process of her wound care, taking off her dressings, her drains, et cetera, et cetera. There are some risks for her during this period. The main risks are wound infections. Can happen. Fortunately, in modern medicine, a lot of the risks that I'll mention, I think Dr. Schein will mention too, are quite rare. But there are risks. There's no question these risks have to be told to the patient at the time of the consult. There could be infections, there could be scarring, there could be skin loss, there can be persistent deformity, there could be nerve damage. There could be. It's possible. Again, They're very rare and very minor, but they're certainly reported and they can happen. And based on this consultation, the patient has to make a decision. And I believe I'll leave it there for my first case, probably, that, if that's okay. Okay? Thank you.
Thank you, Marty, for that interesting introduction. And in a moment, we'll have an opportunity to hear from our Schechter. So first, at this point in time, let me have the tremendous zechus and privilege of introducing Rav Schechter to the audience. Rav Schechter is a person that doesn't need an introduction, and he would probably be much happier with me saying, here is a Rav Schechter. But I would be remiss if I didn't, for the sake of people maybe listening on the tapes to this, the people who will be listening to this in the future, that we are truly privileged and blessed in our community to have a posek of the stature of Rav Schechter giving advice to kimat all the rabbanim in the neighborhood. Whenever shailas come up that are beyond the realm of the local rav, and it needs to go to a posek hador, so we're blessed to have the opportunity to discuss these shailas with Rav Schechter. I had the schus of learning with Rav Schechter when I was at Yeshiva University. I had the schus to learn in his Tuesday night gemarisha for many years after I left the yeshiva, and I've had the opportunity, especially through some of the tapes that the YU website has, to continue constantly learning from the Rebbe. And I thought, to keep things brief, because the Rebbe would probably be upset if I go on anymore, you see sometimes a lot of very bright people in the world, and you see this person gets a Nobel Prize in economics, and this person gets a Nobel Prize in medicine, this person gets a Nobel Prize in this, Lambert Prize, all these fancy prizes. And you ask yourself, wow, these are bright people. Imagine if they had gone into learning, assuming they're Jewish people, imagine if they'd gone into learning. What would we have? And the answer to that is we'd have Rav Schechter. We would have a person who has chosen, not because of lack of a willingness to go and learn secular subjects, but a person who has chosen to spend his life devoted to the Dalet Amos of the Beis Medrash, but to also then apply that halacha to allow others to learn from him, to apply that halacha to practical situations in life. So we can have a discussion on plastic surgery, can have a discussion on the legal ramifications of an aguna, you can have a discussion on business ethics, and you turn to the same individual, you turn to our Rav Schechter to give us a psak halacha. So it's our tremendous kavod and zechus to honor our shul and our community with the presence of Rav Schechter and to his divrei Torah. Rav Schechter is asked if it's okay to speak sitting down, so everybody please pay attention to what the Rav has to say.
I apologize, I have a little trouble with my right leg. I'll sit.
You're a plastic surgeon.
Now that I know some, I will. Okay.
I don't think it's that particular kind of problem.
In the yeshiva years ago, the word used to be that it's a machlokes between Rabbi Soloveitchik and Rabbi Soloveitchik, Baron Soloveitchik, and the Rav, Rabbi Yoshe Ben Soloveitchik, whether one is permitted to perform or undergo cosmetic surgery. I don't know exactly what Rabbi Baron Soloveitchik said, but I doubt that he really said that it was prohibited. When the students would discuss it with the Rav, he gave a very brief psak that you look in the Rambam, in the beginning of Hilchas Chayv Lamazik.
Just try to speak a little bit louder.
Yeah, if I'll stand, it'll be better. I should speak a little louder. Okay. Okay. When the Rambam writes the prohibition against mutilating the body, so the Rambam says it's prohibited to mutilate someone else's body or to mutilate your own body. And then there are two girsas, there are two readings in the Rambam, where he writes that it's prohibited derech nitzayon, if I'm fighting with the other person, ki natsu anashim, if I'm fighting, or derech bizayon, to mutilate someone's body, to be mevazehim. So Rav Soloveitchik, the Rav, used to say that if it's done for cosmetic purposes, neither girsa would see any problem, neither derech bizayon nor derech nitzayon, so he thought that it was certainly permissible. Also, many people may be familiar with the tshuvas of the Minchas Yitzchak, Dayan Weiss, who used to be by the Eidah Haredis when he was in England, he wasn't so Haredi. And when he joined the Eidah Haredis, all of a sudden he became Haredi. It was a little bit Zionistic, and then they straightened him out when he came to Yerushalayim. So he has, usually his tshuvas are very long. He was a Hungarian, Talmid Chacham. Usually his tshuvas are very long. He quotes and he quotes and he quotes. He has a very brief tshuva about the cosmetic surgery. He says the same thing. Look in the Rambam, two readings, it's permissible shun. We have to add on a little bit. Let's say a woman is pregnant and she doesn't like the way she looks. She would rather not be pregnant. So she wants to perform an abortion. So we don't permit this. Now there are those who say that an abortion is prohibited because it's an act of ritzicha. And there are so the only time you would be allowed to perform an abortion is if the mother's life is clearly in danger. The Rambam says then we consider the fetus as a roidif to the mother. And most of the poskim, many poskim don't agree with the Rambam. They say that not until maybe when the mother is in labor already, whatever, it's not considered ritzicha, just an isa chavala. So if it's an isa chavala, so if it's l'tikan aguf, it should be muta. So we say, no, that's not called tikan aguf. This is normal. That that a woman becomes pregnant, has a baby, is considered normal. Nothing unusual about that. If a person has six fingers and he wants to look normal, he wants to cut off the fifth finger, so that's normal. So that's that cosmetic surgery certainly we would permit. If they remove the breast from the woman and she wants to look normal, so she feels bad, the husband feels bad, everybody feels bad. So that cosmetic surgery certainly would be permissible. Person has five fingers and he wants to look unusual, he wants to go into the circus, he wants to have only four fingers, he wants to have six fingers, so that's abnormal. So we have to determine what's considered normal, what's considered abnormal. In the days of the Tanoim, it was a very common practice, maybe it was universal, I don't know, that women would pierce their ears in order to hang jewelry from the ears. Now piercing the ears, I think, usually also involves a little shedding of blood, and nonetheless, it's permissible. Apparently, that whatever is makubal, whatever is accepted by the population, if it's considered normal, then it's considered for the purpose of tikkun aguf.
Don't we have to begin by dividing this shear between halacha permissible for men and for women in today's society? Men are wearing earrings, so why can't we start with earrings? I'm saying, a man, you know, with all due respect, in Maseches Makos, I know there's, I don't remember exactly where, a man's not allowed to pull out a black hair from, a white hair from his black hair. So we have to divide this year, it seems to be, between men and women.
Okay, that's another point. I wouldn't start with that. I would, I don't think fundamentally it's not a difference between men and women. As far as the prohibition of chavala, distorting the body, mutilating the body, the din is the same. The question is what's considered normal. So maybe we live in a society that a lot of women don't want to become pregnant. If they become pregnant, they consider that normal, terminating the pregnancy. So we would say that it is normal to carry a pregnancy. That's abnormal to terminate the pregnancy. And then we would say that as far as men are concerned, certain things are considered abnormal for men because that's the style of women. So it's slightly different between men and women. That is true. That is true. Sure.
She accepted what her father said. And when the next daughter, Tonya, wanted to get her ears pierced, she went to her father. Her father told her the same thing. She said, I can't, you know, all these Orthodox women walking around with their ears pierced, and you're telling me it's Kobel Ba'atzmi. And so Rav Lichtenstein said, okay, let's go to Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. So we went to Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, and Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach said, I don't know anything about piercing ears, but I know that by us, when a boy is born after 8 days, we do a bris. And when a girl is born, we make a hole in each ear.
Yeah, you have Mishnahs like that. The Mishnah in Shabbos talks about when they would pierce the ear, so they would put a little piece of straw in the hole to make sure that it doesn't grow back again. So the Mishnah discusses the women walking in the street with the straw in the hole to prevent it from growing back again, that's not considered hoitzah. So you see clearly from the Mishnayos, more Mishnayos also, that was the practice in the days of the time. It's societal, it depends. If you live in a society where it's not acceptable to pierce the ears, then it would be considered an act of chavolah. Does it change now that in America all the men are walking around with earrings? It depends. What does it represent? Why are the men walking around with earrings?
They want, nirsa?
Huh? Yeah. If they want to demonstrate that they belong to a certain class of society, that's not acceptable. So that's considered abnormal. So we wouldn't permit it. Yeah. I don't know. Speaking on the phone with Rabbi Glatt on Friday, he raised the question, I don't know what the answer is. Let's say I'm a barber and non-Jews come to me for a haircut, so I'm permitted to shave off their beard and their face with a razor. Even though a Jew is not permitted to, and a Jewish barber is not permitted to shave off the beard and the payas of a Jewish customer, but a Jewish barber is permitted to shave off the beard and the payas of a non-Jewish customer. So what about mutilating the body? Is this permissible for a non-Jew? The non-Jews only have the 7 mitzvahs of Bnei Noach. They don't have all the other mitzvahs. So let's say to tattoo the body. I think it's permissible for a non-Jew to tattoo the body. To castrate the body, it's prohibited for a Jew even to cause castration, even on an animal. Certainly on a non-Jewish person. The Talmud even says, the accepted opinion is, that the non-Jews are not permitted to castrate an animal either. It's not one of the 7 mitzvahs been enough, but it's prohibited. So that clearly, a Jewish doctor is not permitted to castrate a Jewish patient. But what about, let's say, to tattoo a Jewish patient, a non-Jewish patient? Let's say, to tattoo an... I think non-Jews are probably permitted to tattoo their bodies, and Jewish doctor would probably be permitted to make a tattoo. Doctors don't make tattoos. A Jewish, whatever they call them. Tattooist, okay.
There is one case we do, which Dr. Shaman will be presenting. So we do actually get involved in our specialty.
Okay. So I would assume it's probably permissible for a Jewish tattooist to make tattoos on the body of a non-Jewish person. It's like shaving off the face of a non-Jew. Is a non-Jew prohibited to mutilate his body? I'm not sure. I think some of the commentaries on the side of the Rambam say that the prohibition against mutilating the body is based on the pasuk Hanashomis Lihein, that we own our clothing, we own our homes, we own our property, but we don't own our bodies. The body belongs to God. So the body of a Jew belongs to God, the body of a non-Jew also belongs to God. So if a non-Jew is going to mutilate his body, he'll also be in violation of Gzela. He's mutilating something that doesn't belong to him. But I don't know if that's the accepted opinion. The Radvaz and the Rambam writes like that, HaNeshamas Lihein, that's a Pasuk in Novi. I don't know if that's the prohibition. It could be that the prohibition is that the Torah doesn't want us to mutilate a Jewish body. It could be that a non-Jew is permitted to mutilate his body. And if he gives me permission, he has 5 fingers and he wants to be in the circus, he wants to have 4 fingers, maybe it would be permissible. I don't know. It's an interesting question. I don't know. Okay, maybe we'll discuss the rest of the cases. We'll discuss them all later.
Did we answer Dr. Kester's question? Did we answer Dr. Kester's question? Is that permitted?
I would think that if the woman feels terrible and she's depressed and the husband feels bad, and the husband feels bad about the face also, I would assume that it's permissible. If this is a common concern that people to the extent that the woman feels depressed that she can't function well, I would assume that it is permissible.
Now what if the husband came in with the same problem? Now what if the husband came in with the same problem?
He wants to tell him about men. He's interested in men.
That's where the problem lies.
Okay, if the husband feels so bad about it. Usually I think women feel worse about this than men. If the husband really...
What is halachically permissible?
If it's
the husband doesn't like his droopy eyelids, can he have his eyelids?
I know a case in California where a man lost his wife. And he was dating another woman. She only agreed to marry him if he takes care of the drooping eyes and so on and so forth. He took care of everything. And now they got divorced 2 years later.
But at that time, it was permissible. Right?
It was permissible.
At that time, it was permissible.
But I know his children were very opposed to the whole shidduch.
Right.
They didn't want the whole shidduch because the conditions were so unreasonable. The husband wanted the shidduch, so he had no parents. So I would think he was a doctor. He is a doctor. So I would think if it really bothers people, I think it is permissible. I just read in Time magazine, I think last week, that there's a 41% increase in chin surgery now.
Implants.
Chin implants.
No, facial.
To change it. People apparently are very bothered about it. If it bothers men and women, so I think it's permissible.
But what can we base that on, halachically, from the sources? I mean, if a man is not allowed to pull a white hair that bothers him in his black beard, the Talmud tells us, how can you allow him to put laminate veneers on his teeth because they're crooked or have to take care of his droopy eyelids?
If his teeth look awful, so I think men are permitted also to touch up their teeth. I don't know, does that involve Kabbalah? Does that involve...
For teeth? I mean, you have to make incisions? It could be. But I mean, Steve, you're using a case of pulling out a hair. I mean, obviously there's a big distinction between randomly pulling out a hair and somebody that is having
that
a cycle...
That's a very minor thing. Obviously, if the Gemara is telling us you can't pull a white hair out of a black beard, it's something a little more invasive.
Certainly not allowed to put on the veneer.
No. They explained before because the man wants to look younger. So that's the style of women. But here, the fellow looks awful. If the fellow looks, he looks like he's much older than he really is. And he feels terrible about that. So many poskim are of the opinion that he is allowed to die. Let's say his hair turned a single boy. He had turned gray and he never even got married. He's only 21 years old. So many poskim say it is permissible to dye your hair because it's abnormal over there. There are those who are machmer. Lubavitcher are machmer because it's semach tzedek, it was very machmer. But non-Lubavitcher are mekel about that. If he's prematurely gray and he looks awful, he just wants to look normal, not that he wants to look Ponce de Leon.
Okay, we'll take a break now for questions and we'll present on this case. There will be time for questions at the end. And I want to make sure that the presenters have an opportunity to go through a number of cases that they have, spend time presenting for us so we can have the benefit of their medical advice and then hear Rav Shech to discuss it. We will have opportunity to go back and discuss any questions on this case or that have been brought up in a few moments. It's my pleasure to introduce our second expert today in plastic surgery, Dr. Marcel Scheinman, who is also a specialist in plastic and reconstructive surgery and has his main office here in the Five Towns as well. He's originally from Brazil and continued his training in the United States here with a residency in general surgery at Maimonides and a fellowship in plastic surgery at New York Presbyterian Hospital, Columbia and Cornell University. He's also a clinical assistant professor of surgery at the Weill Medical College of Cornell for the last 7 years. He's board certified as well by the American Board of Plastic Surgery and the American Board of Surgery. He also does a variety of very skilled and important plastic procedures. And on a personal note, I had the zechus of learning with him Daf Yomi for a while. He's a person who's gone through Shas, made a siyum on Daf Yomi. So again, we have Baruch Hashem, a panelist, both panelists that are Lomdei Torah, Shomrei Torah mitzvah. So this discussion is not just based upon what the secular values are, but these are the medical values seen through the eyes of people of Shomrei Torah mitzvahs, and then we can elucidate the halacha lemaisa with Rav Shech. So Marcel, it's a pleasure to have you here today.
Thank you, Rabbi Glatt. It's a true honor to be part of this panel with distinguished members, Rabbi Schechter, Rabbi Glatt, Dr. Kessler, my friend and colleague. Dr. Kessler started the introduction for the specialty, which he, I think it's an important aspect because, unfortunately, when it comes to cosmetic surgery or to cosmetic treatment in general, aside of the medical part, aside of what we do, there is a lot of a whole gamut of professionals, non-professionals involved. There's a lot of money into the industry of cosmetic in general, billions of dollars in, you know, facial creams will make you look younger, and so this it becomes blur even to aside of the halachas part of it, even from the medical standpoint. Many times patients are confused. They don't, you know, they see things in the internet, in advertisements, and it's incumbent upon us to keep a good standard of practice, to try to differentiate between what is what works, what it doesn't, what it should be done, what it shouldn't be done. And as a Jewish plastic surgeon, as an added very important component of the halacha, as it pertains to all these procedures, in especially in Jewish patients. So the way that we divide it, we have like five or six cases that we like to present, which will touch upon various different aspects of our specialty and with different nuances, I think, in halacha. And I'll start presenting my first case, then maybe, I don't know if we'll open to discussion, if we present all the cases first and then let Rabbi Schechter. Okay. So, when we spoke to Marty Kessler, we divided this topic. First of all, we also choose topics who are relevant and who are in our day-to-day life, they actually are real cases. Obviously didn't make it too obvious, so if it happened to anyone in here, so it doesn't become obvious to them or to the others. But those are real cases that happen, and that's why we're presenting them. So let me start with a 47-year-old who's having her oldest daughter getting married in about 5 weeks from now. And she has gained some weight over the past, added to the stress of the wedding and everything, so she noticed she gained weight. She's unhappy with that. She don't think she's going to fit on her dress. She spent thousands of dollars on it. And she was told by a friend that she could get liposuction. Liposuction will help her, will be the fastest way to lose weight. She's not obese. She doesn't need to lose a significant amount of weight, but she likes to go down one or two sizes on her dress. So, first of all, what is liposuction? For many of you who have heard and don't know exactly how it's done, it's one of the most commonly performed cosmetic procedures in the United States. It's usually done, it's not a complicated or very risky, as actually the risks are minimal, but like everything else, there's always some risk involved. But basically, it's done either under some form of sedation, sometimes general anesthesia. The most common area is the abdomen, the belly, sometimes the thighs. And you could make between two to four little incisions, little cut on the skin. From that, we introduce a cannula made out of usually metal that has holes. And like a vacuum, like an aspirator, it sucks out the fat in those areas. Could be done anywhere from half an hour to 1 hour. The recovery, it's not long. There's some soreness, usually not severe pain. Patients usually in 3 to 7 days are completely recovered from that. And again, it could change that area where the liposuction was done. Usually by removing the fat in that area, you actually may make it slimmer. You could improve the shape and make that woman who needs, to get her daughter married, she'll be happy and she'll fit on her dress.
Again, in the days of the Tanoim, the women used to put on all kinds of, they wanted to have rosy cheeks, and they used to put on plaster on their face for a couple of hours, and then this would bring out the blood. And this, the Mishnah has a whole discussion if you're allowed to do this on Chol HaMoed, but on the weekdays there's no Shaila. This was Chavol also, they wanted to have rosy cheeks. So this was permissible. I would assume this, if this is commonly done, if this is considered acceptable. So I would assume that it's permissible. You're not allowed to put your life in danger if there's a real risk. You're not permitted to put your life with sakana, but if it's a very insignificant risk that normal people are not nervous about, one chance in 100,000 or something like that, even one chance in 1,000, I would assume that people are usually not worried about. If it's a 1% sakana, or even 0.5% of a sakana, I would think that normal people would be concerned about it. So if you really have a serious condition, you have no choice, you have to go through the surgery, even though it's a sakana that people are worried about. But over here, if it's a very slight sakana that normal people are not nervous about, you don't have to worry about the sakana. I don't know. is it really so common that the women are so, the women feel so terrible about being overweight? If she's extremely obese, okay. If she's just a little overweight, I don't know. How common is it that the women really feel so bad about that?
She's extremely obese, the liposuction is not going to work for her.
Not going to help.
I think that's actually a question you can ask the women.
Yeah.
I think that's a question of the women. Will the women feel bad if they're a little overweight and they can't fit into their dress? What's the majority of the answers?
Absolutely.
Okay. So, I mean, seriously, I mean, that's you're saying if it's a socially acceptable thing, if we have 90% of the women raising their hands, they're saying that if I were just in the scenario he gave, going to have my child's wedding, and I unfortunately gained weight, how would I feel again? I mean, that's the line here, I think, in our specialty. How much can you grant the psychological problems and feeling depressed and bad? I mean, if 90% of women here will raise their hand and say, I would feel terrible if I can't get into this dress, and I would run to go like get liposuction.
Okay.
So, there it is.
I think many would run to the seamstress to have her have the seamstress come to their home.
I'm not
probably sure. Be less expensive also.
I'm not sure they would do that if the dress is going to look a little larger.
Uh-huh. So I would assume it's permissible then.
I think that men and women have a different problem, which is all of us have Hollywood eyes. The men look at the women, sometimes influenced by Hollywood, and we women look at ourselves, also influenced by Hollywood. And I think that that's the bigger problem. And that's less expensive, even though it's more difficult to work on. And there's no sakana to the body from learning to see yourself differently from Torah eyes, not from Hollywood eyes.
I'm not disagreeing with you. I think that's a excellent point. But what do Dr. Shimon and I do with a patient who comes in that doesn't have your very logical and probably correct way of thinking about things? I'm not saying your way is not correct. So that's where the question arises. What do you do with a patient that comes to you that truly has emotional, psychological issues? I mean, I don't think there's any question if it's pure, total vanity that's ludicrous. I could tell you, and he probably will give you the same answer, I've had people come to my office with those requests that I did them a fond to do. I say, I'm not the right doctor for you, and perhaps my Jewish Orthodox ethical feelings that you have are the same reason that I do that, whereas maybe some non-Jewish plastic surgical colleague would do it because, you know, like he said before, it's money, it's a case, somebody wants to do it, I'll do it. So I'm not disagreeing with you. I think for us as a group of people, of from Orthodox Jews, the question is, yes, you're right. I think our society is filled way much with vanity today, no question about it, okay? What do you do about people that have other reasons that need to have it done? And I think Rabbi Schacht has approached that. I think in most cases it's appropriate. Am I right or wrong? Right?
I think so.
Yeah. Okay.
Before
a
woman goes to a major, let's say, facelift or whatever, do you ever suggest that she go, let's say, to a psychologist to explore, you know, why she's doing
It depends on what her reasons are. I mean, I just said to you before, I mean, there are patients that will come to me that I think they're inappropriate. I will sometimes say maybe you should see someone for therapy. Absolutely. Right. I mean,
also, as plastic surgeons, the last thing that you want to do is to perform a procedure, an operation, especially a cosmetic operation, on somebody who is not a good candidate or who does have some psychological underlying problems, because what's going to happen, no matter what the outcome is, she's going to be unhappy. And she's going to make us unhappy. So it is also incumbent upon us. There are certain patients, certain people who have like body dysmorphic disorders, which is actually a severe spectrum, like almost a psychological disease. And they'll go and they'll seek cosmetic surgery. And if you happen to be the unlucky one who operates on this woman, you're going to regret that. So we also, part of our training and experience also comes in dealing, interacting with people, patients, and when they come in, look at their motivations, look if it's reasonable what they're requesting. Some patients say, listen, I want my nose redone, and you say, okay, well, tell me what bothers you in your nose, and they start pointing to minutiae that's absolutely not something that doesn't make sense, or to, and
you know right there that that's not a person you want to touch. So we don't routinely, if a person come and you have a reasonable request and reasonable reasons and just upon talking to them, they seem to be stable, psychologically stable, we don't have a reason to say, okay, go first to the psychologist and then come back to me, because she'll never come back to you. She'll say, you know, she'll go to her husband and say, I went to my eyelids, then you call me crazy. So that's not how it works. But however, we should be always attuned to that. And there are cases that will say, okay, you go first to a psychologist, psychiatrist, and
there's always a sakana when you're going under a knife or going under general anesthesia. There's someone in that area a few years back, went for a plain liposuction, a healthy woman, and she never got off the table, she had cardiac arrest. Now, vanity plays a major portion here of doing this procedure. Not only this procedure, I mean, it could be any kind of procedure, an endoscopy or whatever it is, you're always taking a chance that something can happen. I really don't know the percentages, but I'm sure that the lawyers in the room know how many patients end up with different kind of problems after the procedures, and there's always lawsuits, and doctors are always going to court to defend themselves. So is this halakhically acceptable or not? I mean, you're taking a chance. The doctors will tell you, no, it happens once in a million. It's not true. I mean, the lawyers in the room can tell you better than that. But malpractice is, these are way up in this particular reason. So when you say that it's normal, I don't know if it's normal to go under a procedure, under a knife, general anesthesia for 6 hours or whatever it is, just to make yourself look a little happy. Is it worth it? I don't know.
The Gemara quotes the pasuk Shem Epsoim Hashem. The Rebbeinu Shlom watches over the fools, even though they don't take care of their health. So the Gemara applies that principle to any situation where a person is putting himself into a suffix sakana that's nowhere near 50-50, and the percentage is such that the general population is not nervous about it. Sometimes it depends on each individual person. If this person is nervous about the sakana, let's say flying an airplane is ridiculous, I think. If the person is nervous, we would tell them also to take a tranquilizer. I don't think, but there are other cases, other sakanas, where it's up to the patient, it's up to the person. If he personally is nervous, let's say there's a 1% chance of dying or having something terrible happen. So 1% depends on this person. If he personally is nervous, then for him it's called the suffix sakana. For someone else, it's not called the suffix sakana. It's 1 chance in 1,000, I think, even for the one who's nervous, it wouldn't be considered a suffix sakana. So we have to find out what the likelihood is of how high the risk is. If it's a risk of less than 1 in 1,000, how many people don't wake up from the anesthesia?
It's a much smaller.
It's very small.
One and a half million.
No.
Yeah.
It's very small.
You're talking in terms of a young, healthy person. Yes. Healthy
right.
Person.
Correct.
I think the numbers are about 1 in 50,000 to 1 in 100,000 patients who, unfortunately, may have
morbidity. Much smaller than that.
Again, I believe that is.
No. Those are the exact numbers. That's the numbers that's put out. The point isn't what the number is. The point is that it's below the threshold that Rav Shechter says is considered a suffix sakana for a normal
person.
Yeah,
that's not called a suffix sakana.
I guess statistically to the two surgeons, the points that you could address there, specifically, what percent of your patients, hundreds of thousands of patients per year over the years, what percent of your patients are coming in for what you would describe as vanity purposes, these persons who come in for either psychological or real physical issues that they have to deal with?
All right, but you're still talking in terms of cosmetic, because again, we made a distinction between reconstructive, congenital. I think there's no question in anybody's mind that that's permissible. I think that, you know, the truth is, people also learn to say things, by the way, that make it sound like it's more functional than just vanity. I mean, for instance, everybody knows the trick. Go to the plastic surgeon, you want your nose done, and tell them that you have difficulty breathing. So, you know, so you can get your nose done, because once it goes into the realm of it being difficulty breathing,
then you're doing something functional for the patient rather than something cosmetic. I think that's a very hard statistic.
This is a very important halachic question that I'd like to ask that the Rav Schefter maybe could address as well. Is it permissible, if the insurance company will only pay for it if it's for therapeutic and you really want it for cosmetic, is it permissible to not state the truth and defraud the insurance company?
Who's going to know that?
That's a very important halacha that people need to be aware of. You're not allowed to say that something's for breathing purposes if it's not.
Well,
so you could probably have a very good feel from your perspective, even if the patient is saying to you A, you probably have a good feel whether it's A or P.
Yeah, well, because to answer both at the same time, and I could tell when I examine the patient whether there's truly something functional there or not, particularly when it comes to a rhinoplasty. I could look in there and say, yes, there's something that's blocking the breathing. When I look in there and I'll see it's not, I'll go in my mind, oh, you know, they mentioned they're having difficulty breathing because I know why they're telling me they're having difficulty breathing. And I think to answer the rest of your question, it's a very hard statistic to put together. I mean, you're asking on a very vague way to try to make a distinction between somebody that's pure vanity and somebody that has some other reason, psychological, you know, it's very, very hard to figure that out. But it is, as Marcel said, our job to try to do that. And it's a very important job because, as he stated before too, you really don't want to touch some people that are really asking for inappropriate surgery that really is based on no need for it at all. But I can tell you there are, in my practice, I mean, Baruch Hashem, okay, most of the people that come to me with legitimate complaints are legitimate. I mean, they really have problems that need to be fixed. And for instance, when I get to present the next case, I see Dr. Kahl on the left, but, you know, he kept persisting on the male issue because I think Steve and I are actually very good friends. He was talking to me over Shabbos about him. He had gone to a lecture when he was not near that one. During the Shever Brachas yesterday, okay, that he had gone to a lecture when he was a pre-med student, and this was way back when, and the distinction was made from at that point that men are never allowed to have cosmetic surgery. And I said that I found it very hard to believe. I know from what I looked into being able to do this as a specialty, and I'm glad to hear your opinion, Rabbi Schachter, that's not true. And I think you told him that, your opinion too. But in my next case, I was hoping he'd be here. I mean, and this is an actual patient that I pulled out of my records, that I think once I present the case, there's going to be no question in anybody's mind that this person, even though it's going to be a lengthy operation with a lot of risk, has every right to go through the surgery, because why should he live the rest of his life this way? So, based on that, if you want me to present, get a second, present.
Okay.
Yeah, okay. So, this case I was talking about was a 39-year-old gentleman who had had bariatric surgery. You know what that is? That's weight loss surgery. So he had originally weighed 320 pounds. He had what's called a gastric bypass operation, and he's dropped his weight to 200 pounds. Okay. Fortunately, after his surgery, his diabetes has gone away, his high blood pressure has gone away, a lot of his medical problems are gone. However, now he's off all his medications. Now he's left, though, with some problems. He has a lot of excess skin. And he's a male. He's a guy, okay? The large areas of excess skin include his stomach. He has something called a paniculus, which means in Latin an apron of skin that still hangs in his pants. He has difficulty getting good clothing. He gets rashes under his abdomen. It's uncomfortable in the summertime. Not only that, he has a very embarrassing situation. He has his chest, after he lost all his weight, has droopy, hanging pieces of skin. They actually look like women's breasts. It's something that's called gynecomastia, okay? That's the technical term. You know, he's extremely unhappy. He's not married. He's been single. He's never been able to socially get involved with a woman. He still feels difficulty getting involved socially with a woman. And he's a male, okay? So, Dr. Collender, you're not here, but is this guy allowed to have plastic surgery? I don't think there's any question. He's going to go through a big operation. He's going to go through something called an abdominoplasty paniculectomy, which is about a five-hour procedure. That's just part of his operation. He happens to be healthy, so he can go through about 8 hours of anesthesia. Because the other 3 hours that I operated on him, I did a gynecomastia operation. I actually had to take out the skin and move the nipple and make his chest look normal. And now he's going to have scars on his chest going vertically and horizontally and scars around his belly, but his whole body's going to be reshaped. And there are large risks with this procedure, not small. These people can get blood clots in their legs, they can get pulmonary emboli. You have to put them on medications that keep their blood thinned out for the entire week after surgery. They can bleed after surgery. They have a lot of post-op care, and it takes almost 6 to 8 weeks to recover from the operation. I actually did the surgery. It's a very happy guy today. So I would tell you that, again, and I don't want to get redundant, but I don't think, and I will give Rabbi Schachter the podium now, I don't think in this particular case, in my patient, is there a problem with a patient like this, even though he's a male. Okay? And I'll discuss it with Dr. Colander later.
I would assume that it was permissible. The shaila is that you say that there were a lot of risks.
There are risks, but risks within the realm of modern medicine today that are treatable and controlled. Exactly, I should have said that. You know, the blood clots today, you know, Rabbi Glatt can tell you, we have wonderful medicines today. Whereas 50 years ago, he could have had this operation, and he could have died without any question, with a 35-40% chance of getting a pulmonary embolism. Today, that chance is minimized. We have wonderful ways today, and I think that's one of the points today. With all the modern changes in medicine today, we have lots of ways to minimize many, many, many of the risks that people think could happen from the surgery. Because if someone does get an infection, it is treatable. Now, you know, what Dr. Thurm talked about before, that was an unfortunate incident. Someone going through anesthesia and dying from anesthesia. We read about it in the papers because they glorify that. But I will tell you, Myron, that I think your comment that it's very, very common for this to happen is not true. I mean, the statistic you'd ask of an attorney, any attorneys in the audience, I would be careful on what statistics they give you, and I would try to ask the statistics of the surgeons that you really know the true statistics of these complications. So.
Let me take the liberty of rephrasing the question in a way where it's not such a obvious answer. Let's assume that the patient's bariatric surgery...
You listen to the patient.
Let's assume that the scenario was where the bariatric surgery was not successful and the patient had the similar needs but had gained back some of the weight but still had it. Assuming the surgical risk now was 50%, what would the Rav say in that situation? Assuming the surgical risk was much, much higher than the very low level, serious complication risk of, let's say, 1% to 2%, at what point would the Rav say such surgery, purely for, quote, cosmetic and psychological reasons, would be permissible? Is there a 10% risk, if that's assuming that, well, everybody could agree upon the risk? Is a 50% risk then considered too much? Does the Rav have an opinion as to what is an acceptable risk and what's no longer an acceptable risk for something that's not life-threatening?
A 50% risk of losing your life?
Yes.
Ooh. That, certainly not allowed.
Okay, so what about lower than
near
that?
It.
Between 2% and 50%, is there, in halacha, is there a cutoff number for what's considered an acceptable risk?
We usually assume that 10% is considered a miyotam atzai. So that's, we usually assume that that's called Shechiyah Hazeka. 10% is also serious. 10% risk is also very serious.
I just want to make one comment on Rabbi Schachter is mentioning that I believe that any responsible plastic surgeon doesn't want to take upon doing a procedure which risks go above what's reasonable, because we're putting ourselves and the patient at risk too. So it's not, I believe that anybody who practices good, safe medicine will evaluate this and would refuse probably, which many times I've done, and I'm sure Marek has done as well, to say to patients, listen, your risk is too high, we're not doing this operation for you. So, and it doesn't, and I thank Rabbi Schachter for so far making our lives very, very much easier than I thought he would. But it seemed like the numbers that we quote in Rabbi Schachter, they pretty much, they agree with each other. I mean, what the halacha say is the same thing that practicing good medicine say as well.
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing. I mean, Aaron, to answer your question, I think that, you know, and you know, as a physician, I think if someone came to me with a 50% risk of an operation, just as Marcel said, I don't think any surgeon in his right mind that's qualified, board certified, would sit with that patient and say, hey, yeah, let's go for this. You know, so the truth is, if someone comes in who hasn't lost the weight and the risks are so great, what both of us would say to the patient is go back, lose some more weight, bring your risks down to a level that's
understandable. You know, the truth is 10% may even be a little bit high for me. I'm not even sure 10% would be good enough for me. 10% gives me a sense of discomfort. That means 1 out of 10 patients that I operate on, I'm going to have a risk. I would never want to do that for the reason Myron said. I would never want to have risks of 10%, 15%. So actually, according to halacha, if that's the case, that's actually quite makel. I mean, to have 10% risk. For me, I'd like the risk to be 1%, 2%, 3%. I'm already starting to get a little sweaty under the arms when I'm thinking 3%. So like Marcel says, I think any good, responsible surgeon, whether a from plastic surgeon, a non-from plastic surgeon, would not even, and it goes back to your comment, I would send that patient home. I would say, not interested. You're not ready. You're not ready to have the surgery.
So. Well, these numbers that Shafter pointed out are critical numbers in terms of not only for plastic surgery, but they're even critical numbers sometimes for undergoing procedures that might have sopek pikuach nefashos questions attached to them. At what point is a patient allowed to undergo a procedure that might have a chance of improving their long-term life but has a very significant short-term risk to it? And it's not really the subject for today's discussion, but that's one of the specific reasons that I wanted those numbers brought out. Having these discussions with Schachter in the past on much more complex cases, those numbers of 10% and 50% are halachic markers, if you wish, for some serious discussion from a halachic point of view whether certain procedures can be done.
Now, is this 10% specific to, you know, to dying, if you will? So let's say that it's like 7% risk that the person, you know, you're deceased, but then there's like a 5% chance that he may undergo nerve damage. So cumulatively, that's 12%, or are we breaking up from saying because both are under 10%, there'll be a lot of mother?
One is not permitted to commit suicide, nor is one permitted to mutilate his body. So if you have a 12% risk of causing a mutilation to the body, either by dropping dead, 10%, or by mutilating the nerves, so you're not allowed to do it.
And I'll take the liberty of asking the question now on the other side. Assuming that there is no obvious, even cosmetic reason for the person to do so, but they're in a profession where the need to look young, even though they don't personally feel that need, they're an anchor person on a local television show, and the push is to get a younger person in that position. Would a person for parnassa purposes be allowed to undergo any of the procedures that we talked about, assuming that the risk was minimal, but it would be in fact chavola?
There's what to discuss. The Sri Deyesh has a discussion about that. When a man wants to look younger, he just wants to look at it, not for parnassa purposes. So that's when the Gemara says that it's not permissible. But if he wants to look younger for a job, he's not allowed to fool them into believing that he's younger than he is. That's a different thing. Let's say a person applies for a job, and if he's over 60, they don't want him, so he makes believe that he's younger. So that you're not allowed to take the job under false pretenses. But they know how old he is. He's not fooling the company. They know how old he is, but they want someone who looks younger. So there's room to say that for parnassa purposes, that would be permissible. The Sri Deyesh has a tshuva where he negotiates a heter, and then he says Lubavitcher should be machmer because the Tzemach Tzedek was more machmer, but others are mekel about that.
Yes.
You had brought up that sometimes you do plastic surgery, but there's other health issues involved. Just a question: let's say a woman wants some kind of breast surgery, either to minimize or to enhance. Does breast cancer have anything to do? Is there a risk for breast cancer with women doing that?
Obviously, that's out of the realm of this topic today, so I'm not sure I'll answer you very briefly. It's a very whole different issue. I mean, I guess we could talk about that privately, but there's been many studies done to try to see whether implants or cutting into breast tissue creates the increased incidence of breast cancer. But in all studies that have been done, it doesn't increase the... Briefly, the answer is no. It doesn't increase any risk of breast cancer. Right. In other words, can you create it? Now, what you're basically asking is, can you create another illness by doing something cosmetic? Well, I mean, illnesses such as infections and sepsis are different type of problems, but your specific focused question of cancer, I don't think any studies ever showed you increase the risk of cancer by doing cosmetic surgical procedures.
Preventing may, if you think a woman who have a very large, enlarged breast and wants to have a breast reduction, it just from the logic standpoint, if you're removing tissue, you may be decreasing the chance. But also, you know, there's no studies that prove that, so that would not be a valid reason to do. But certainly, there's no increased chance of there's no implication of any of these surgeries on the breast with breast cancer.
That's actually a very interesting topic, which, you know, we didn't discuss, Robert Glad, which is there's a whole movement today for doing what's called prophylactic mastectomies. And it gets into a whole realm of medical issues, both ethically in halakha and even ethically when it comes to societal issues. And that is you know, can a woman, because let's say she has breast cancer anxiety, just go to a surgeon and say, I want my breast taken off. I know that I can go to a plastic surgeon and have them rebuilt. Of course, in contrast to a woman that has a strong family history of breast cancer, you're all familiar with the BRCA gene. They go in, they're BRCA positive. And in those cases, you know, they're going to come in and say, I need my breast taken off, and they're going to have it done. So that's an interesting topic in itself, whether someone can come in and request that. And I've been involved in those issues and had to be involved with making decisions on that.
We actually had a symposium here at the shul on that about 2 years ago. And it is a very interesting subject, and maybe if there's time at the end for question and answers, we can revisit some of that again. Certainly, it is unfortunately a very important question for women who do have either a strong family history or they have genetic predisposition, and where it becomes much less from a medical point of view indicated is when there is no such strong family history and when there is no genetic reason to do so, when it's just an anxiety situation. And maybe we can have time for questions at the end about that. But I'd like to go on to Marcel's next case.
So I'm going to present the next case, which is on the topic that Rabbi Shech decided to talk about, which is tattooing. And actually, in our specialty, there are instances that we get involved in that. So this is a 50-year-old, one of my patients. She have had breast cancer in one breast. She underwent a mastectomy. And I performed two operations to reconstruct her breast. On this case, she had a reconstruction done using an implant, which was done in two stages. Sometimes we do different type of operations where we use her own tissue and we could do in one stage. And that's always after that, I mean, the next step and the last step of this reconstruction to try to match as best as possible the contralateral breast. We're going to she's coming to have her nipple and areola tattooed. She's going to have it tattooed at the same shape and color as the other areola, so she could look as normal as possible. And this is the most, is an accepted and probably the most effective way to perform this reconstruction. And obviously come, she's my patient, she's Jewish, I'm Jewish, and come on the question of tattooing, which is a separate halacha altogether, there's a prohibition de horaisa to tattoo the body, aside of what we talk about chavala now, and this is a topic of tattooing. Permit me to jump ahead, maybe talk, but I want to, obviously, Rabbi Schechter will speak about too, but I know when I first looked into this topic and I went to learn to do the tattooing myself and bought equipment and everything, this was obviously a concern. And I asked Charles, and that actually I was happy to know that there's written a tshuva from Rav Eliashiv that he matir, but he said it's preferable that a Jewish doctor don't do it himself on the patient. And for that reason, I actually hired a technician who come to my office. So I do the designing of, I outline the shape. We together choose, or she usually is better than me on choosing the color to match. I do sometimes I perform local anesthesia around, so this become a painless procedure done in the office. And she actually does the actual tattooing, so we don't get into this halachic problem specifically on a Jewish patient.
Before Rav Schechter has an opportunity to answer, I'll just say there are other indications outside of plastic surgery where we do tattoo in medicine. And Rahman al-Islam, if a person sometimes needs radiation therapy, so in order to mark the exact location, they'll sometimes make small tattoos, small marks, so that the radiation can be delivered to the exact site where the beam should go and not to impact upon healthy normal tissue. So that's clearly an even more obvious halachic situation where there would be sakonis nefashos, and the Rav can answer maybe both of those scenarios.
Several years ago, I was told the psak of Rav Yashiv. They never told me the last line that you have to have a non-Jew. They told me that Rav Yashiv said that although for the purpose of writing on Shabbos, we don't distinguish between writing letters or drawing a picture. Drawing a picture is also a malacha of kosev. But with respect to tattooing, he felt that only writing letters is a biblical prohibition, and drawing a picture would only be rabbinical. And since over here the woman will be very depressed, the woman will suffer if she doesn't have this psychologically. She will suffer psychologically if she doesn't have the nipple drawn on her body. So he thought that since it's only an issur derabbanan, we should permit it in a situation of a chodesh ein b'sakana. That's what I was taught. They didn't tell me the last line that you should have a non-Jew do it. Okay. I always thought it was permissible for the Jewish doctor to perform that part.
Is this based upon Kavod HaBrios?
No. He said it's an issur derabbanan and we have a din in Hilchos Shabbos. When you have a chodesh ein b'sakana, you're permitted to violate the rabbanans.
But if it's a derabbanan, why wouldn't Kavod HaBrios be a reason as well?
Kavod HaBrios? Okay, sometimes Kavod HaBrios. I mean, even if the person doesn't suffer, even
right,
if she doesn't suffer psychologically, could be. Got to think about that one. Okay.
And would it make a difference? This comes up often, maybe the panelists will have a case of this. I don't want to steal their thunder. Does it make a difference if the woman says, it bothers me, but the husband says, doesn't bother him, or vice versa? Is the woman allowed to do this solely to please the husband, even though she has it doesn't make a difference to her? Or if the husband says, I don't need you to do this, does that change the halachic issue at all?
I was told in the name of Rav Yashiv that it's only permissible if the woman is going to be seriously psychologically affected by not doing it. So he considered such a psychological state of depression or anxiety as a cholu shem sakona. She's not going to be able to function normally because she's been so upset. So he allowed this issa, what he thought was an issa derabbanan, a makom cholu shem sakona.
And to please the husband. She's doing it solely for shalom bayis, solely to please the husband.
She doesn't feel bad about it.
It doesn't bother her, but he says it bothers him.
I don't know if he should be permissible there. I don't know. She wants to retain her marriage. You gotta do something. I don't know. Gotta think about that.
Okay. It's actually a little bit of almost my next scenario. So it's close. It's not exactly the scenario, but it's close. So, and I actually picked this one because, again, if you notice, the few other cases I mentioned were these big mega cases, which is surgeons Marcel and I do all the time. But there are many other specialties and colleagues in the room here that I think it doesn't just apply to the two of us dealing with it, but I see dermatologists in the audience and cosmetic dentists, and you know that there's a lot of cosmetic stuff done in dermatology, and there's an overlap where we do some of this some of these procedures as well. And in cosmetic dentistry, there are incisions made and cuts made in gums and implants that are put in and things like that. So I decided to give a case that's not as dramatic, where maybe it's not as clear-cut, and also, like Rabbi Glatt just mentioned, where perhaps the psychological reasons are a little suspect. So I have a patient come to me who's a 39-year-old lady, and she has some very early signs of aging. The typical thing. She's noticing some wrinkles on her forehead. She's got some wrinkles between her eyes. She's got wrinkles on the side of her eyes. She looks down around her mouth. She's got the little nasolabial folds, you know, in the commercial, they call it the little parentheses developing around her mouth over here. And, she's unhappy. By the way, she said to her husband, I think I'm going to go see a plastic surgeon and discuss it. And he says, I think you're crazy. I think you look beautiful to me. I don't see anything wrong with this. I mean, everything looks wonderful. And basically, I don't agree with it. But she says, you know, honey, I go to the gym. I go to the gym every day. And everybody in the gym, I'm looking at them, and the wrinkles are gone. They don't have the wrinkles anymore, and I'm saying that they must be doing something. Something's going on here, and I'm seeing the commercials, and I'm looking in Red Book magazine, and I have a feeling they're doing Botox, and I think they're doing maybe some of this stuff called like Juva something or Juvederm or Resta something, Restylane. So,
So she has a discussion with me, and I say, yeah, you know, there are things you can do. I mean, there are these what we call ancillary procedures, but of course they involve needles, and they're not as dramatic, they're not as risky, but you do have to shed blood. I mean, if I have to put local anesthetics in, and I have to put lots of needles in the skin, and you can have a Botox treatment, which basically involves, you know, multiple needle sticks all over your forehead, and a little bit of bleeding, a little bit of bruising, and you know, I can do these what's called the hyaluronic acids, which are Juvederm or Restylane, and fill in your little parentheses around your mouth, and if those little wrinkles on your lip where you have those bleed stick, those bleed lip lines, you know, they call the lipstick bleed lines where the lipstick runs up a little bit, there's a nice procedure called like an acid peel or a laser peel. I could take my machine out and I can go around your mouth. But by the way, when I do this acid peel, it's really a second degree burn. I mean, that's what it is. I mean, I'm burning your skin. I mean, I have to burn you so that the skin will blister and peel, and when it heals, it's going to be nice and smooth, and then we'll, you know, it shouldn't scar. Everything's going to look perfectly well. But yeah, I could do stuff to help you. So let's go ahead. Let's go do it. I'll do it for you right now.
We said before that it's only for the sake of vanity, and the husband is not upset, then we shouldn't really do the chavala.
Yeah, but everybody in the gym has it done.
Everybody has vanity.
Switch gyms.
Switch gyms. The woman basically.
Yeah, I mean, everybody in society is doing it today.
It has become acceptable.
Oh boy, ask the women again. I don't know. I don't ask the women.
The creams they put on. The advertised creams. I never used, thank God, but there are creams.
Okay.
Take away some of the wrinkles or whatever.
Well, again, the question from a halachic point of view is if you're doing a chavolah, the putting on the creams, I don't think invokes any shiloh on a weekday to put on those
correct
creams. The only shilohs would be on Shabbos or Yontif. The halachic question being posed to Rav Shechter is, you do draw blood. Is it a psik ratio that you're going to draw blood? Is it a vada every time you do the procedure that you're going to draw blood?
If you put the needle in the skin, you get bleeding, you get a little blood come out, you can get a bruise.
It's a vaday chavola.
For sure.
And it's not something that is at all in any way life-threatening.
Now again, it's not life-threatening. It's a minor procedure.
But so is, you know, piercing the ears. So it's also a vaday chavola. So it's come to the, you know, the question of the accepted society, you know, accepted custom in society.
If it becomes accepted, then it's permissible.
We have that delicious.
Does it make a difference, Rebbe? If how do you define society for this? When this shaila is halacha lemaisa asked to me or to Rabbi Billet, does it make a difference where the person lives, or is this something that is viewed in the Shomer Torah mitzvahs community, or is this dependent upon your community? Is the same halacha apply?
You mean I live among non-Jews?
No. You live in the five towns versus living in
Beitar.
Lakewood versus living in Beitar versus
okay,
living...
Is it
dependent upon the local community that you live in standards, or is it dependent on an objective halachic standard?
I would assume it does depend on your community. If in your community this is acceptable, so then it's not considered chavala? I would assume so. Unless it's acceptable by people who want to join a lower level of society. But if they're normal people and they just want to look a little better, even though the husband is not upset, okay, so then it's acceptable.
Rabbi, can a firm person go into this profession of cosmetic surgery knowing that predominantly he's dealing with Ashes Ish, who's handling in a very, perhaps, you know, somewhat sexual way, particularly if you're talking about if you're talking about cosmetic breast surgery, where it's purely cosmetic, and it's not going to save the person's life, it's not to quote nefesh in any way, shape, or form, but it's a very good profession, and I'm going to make a lot of money doing that, but I'm handling anxious issues on a regular basis. Is that a consideration for whether I should just do that as a profession or not?
Yeah.
Is it possible that Rabbi Yashiv had that in mind when he was saying that a guy should perform it? So if, why should you be handling anxious issues on a regular basis if it's not a Tzorach real reform? Is that a legitimate concern at all?
It's always preferable to have women doctors treat women patients and male doctors treat the male patients. But if the best one in the field is someone from the other gender, so that's permissible also. I assume that we assume that a doctor who's treating his patients is not going to have hirurim. Sometimes they do. So such a doctor should not. I remember there was a certain doctor who told me when he was single, he had problems. And after he got married, he didn't have any more problems treating the female patients. Okay? So they should make sure that they get married before they go into this field.
When it comes to these cosmetic procedures, that you can fully just put it in a category of vanity. I think there is always an underlying psychological perception of self that is being brought to each and every doctor, whether it's to Dr. Kessler, Dr. Scheinman, to myself, that somebody is bothered by the way they look. Their perception of who they are can change by doing a procedure. So no differently than people buy a pair of designer glasses or put on a nice suit or buy a $3,000 chaetel, and I'm talking about the women, but it's the same with men putting on a nice business suit or a tie. We project an image of ourselves and what we're comfortable with. And when a person feels badly about themselves and in a way has a way with low risk but high benefit of changing that perception so they feel better about themselves, I think it has to go beyond just a vanity question. So that 39-year-old that Dr. Kessler brought up, who sees all the other women in the gym, she's clearly looking around and saying, you know, I'm not looking quite like this. I don't feel so good about myself, and I think there has to be some merit to it. If you take it one step further, I had a patient about 8 years ago come in a week before having a bilateral mastectomy to have Restylane for wrinkles injected around her mouth. And my secretary couldn't understand how she'd be coming in a week before surgery to have this cosmetic procedure. And I explained to her that it was the only thing that she had control over to give herself a better feeling about herself as a person and as a woman before she was heading into this majorly traumatic operation that she was not going to have any control over. So I think we have to look at both sides. I think it can't be just looked at, oh, it's just vanity, and people want to just look at their wrinkles and make fun of that because their perception of who they are may be different from the other people in this room, but it's real to them.
So you would think that it should be permissible even if it doesn't become so widespread?
I think
if it really bothers the person.
Every case has to be looked at
individually. Sure.
So ask a patient, what is it that bothers you, or why is it that bothers you? Again, if it's high risk, I think it's a non-discussion because we're not looking to do high-risk procedures that are going to put the patient in harm's way. But if we're talking about low-risk procedures that are going to give a patient gain, and if that gain even is on a psychological basis for that individual, it's not within me to judge what that person's own psyche is upset about. That it's real to them. It may not be real to the next patient, or that next patient may have something different that's bothering them. But each one has to be looked at with the merit of what they're upset about. So I don't think you can put it in a boilerplate. It can't be an algorithm that if you have X, you should do Y. Every individual has to be looked at for themselves, and then the appropriate medical decision has to be made.
Well, and Karen, that's what I was saying to the question earlier. I mean, it's the same concept, and that is that, you know, it's very hard to put a he asked me for a statistic on that. You can't put a statistic on what's pure vanity and not vanity. It is a very individual situation, and hopefully the physician involved, you know, has enough skill to determine, you know, as Dr. Lish is saying, whether it's an appropriate request to the patient or not an appropriate request. And that has to be in the hands of the physician making the decision.
Sounds good.
So Rebbe, let me play devil's advocate in that situation. The Issur Chavala is able to be negated by a person feeling uncomfortable a bit. How significant does that uncomfortable a bit have to be? And let's put it then into a context. We're in the middle of the Sfira right now. Certainly only a minhag to shave or not to shave, take a haircut, not to take a haircut. Person feels very bad that they don't like the way that they look. Would that be enough of a reason? They feel bad. They have legitimate, they don't like the way that they look. Is that enough of a halachic reason to allow somebody to be over a minhag? And here we're talking about a din. So what does the Rebbe have to say?
Shaving the Sfira. Rabbi Soloveitchik always used to explain, he used to shave in Sfira. Rabbi Soloveitchik always used to shave in Sfira. When he had only a goatee, he used to shave on the side. So he explained that there are three different levels of Avelis, the Shiva, the Shloshim, and if a parent dies, then you have Yud Beis Chodesh, and the Sfira corresponds to the Yud Beis Chodesh, and an Avelis and Yud Beis Chodesh, the din is If one is not permitted to take a haircut until he really looks bit. So if he really looks bit, he's allowed to take a haircut. So our practice is that after Shlosh Mazovit, people shave regularly. That's what Rav Soloveitchik said, that since Sfira is like Yud Beis Chodesh, you're allowed to shave regularly. And the Shulchan Aruch, it says, the Ramah has a minig, that even though the one who's in Velus for a parent after the Shlosh is up is allowed to take the haircut, when he looks awful, when he really needs it. So the Ramah writes, a meeting in Poland was that if they would stay in the Jewish ghetto, in the Jewish neighborhood, they wouldn't take a haircut for the whole year. If you're Hoylach Ben Anachrim, then you're allowed to. So Rav Soloveitchik thought that he was Hoylach Ben Anachrim. we live in integrated communities. You go on the airplane, you go together with non-Jews. So you revert back to the Ikar HaDin. If a person, there are people that stay in the yeshiva all the time. They never leave the yeshiva. Okay, so let them not shave during the whole Yud Beis Chodesh.
But let's say it's during the Shlosha. But he feels bad about it. He doesn't like the way he looks.
No, during Shloshim is a real din, that a person is not allowed to take a haircut, even if he looks bad. Unless it's Nivel Merubah. The whole din, the din of Shiva is we require Nivel Merubah. Din of Shloshim is we require Nivel B'miktsas. Din of Yud Beis Chodesh is that we require Miut Tanugim. So if one is observing Shiva, and it goes past Nivel Merubah, goes into the category of Mitztayer, let's say a person doesn't bathe for 7 days. So by us, we would start to itch all over the place. So then the Mishnah says you're allowed to bathe in the middle of Shiva. Or in the middle of Shloshim, if it enters, a person is observing the prohibition against the haircut and so on, and it enters into the category of Nivel Merubah. So that's more than Shloshim requires. So then it would be permissible, but not a hetter, by definition of the Isser of shaving in Shloshim. Once it enters into the category of Nivel Merubah, it's mutter already.
So that's my point. So in this situation, do you need to reach the point of Nivel Merubah? Or is...
What, to permit chavol on the body?
Yeah.
I don't think so. Just to look better. There's no nivel at all to pierce the ears, or for the woman to look better.
No, for the injections.
For the injections, yeah.
So the chavol is
if
not...
If it improves the body, so then if a tikkun aguf, there's no isa chavol. The question, what do you mean tikkun aguf? The person looks good the way they are now. But if everybody feels that's the common practice, everybody likes to pierce their ears, all the women want to pierce their ears, they want to be able to hang on earrings. So that's considered tikkun aguf. Tikkun aguf, by definition, there's no isa. It's not that it's a heter. Rabbi Al-Yashiv's heter was that there's an isa of tattooing, but the makom chodesh emes hakana, if the woman is going to be suffering psychologically, that she doesn't look feminine, and she's going to be suffering psychologically, and so then you can allow an Issa de Rabbana. That's a heter and an Issa. But this here, we're not talking about a heter and an Issa. By definition, there's no Issa. Whenever there's tikkun aguf, there's no Issa. So tikkun aguf is either if the woman, the person, whoever the person feels, usually women, feel psychologically uncomfortable about themselves, or if it's clear that this is considered beautifying the body. Doesn't even have to be that they feel terrible about it. Just for the sake of vanity, so then there's no head.
Doesn't wanting to look more feminine imply, whether it's for themselves, whether it's for their husbands or whoever, doesn't that imply some sort of problem with the kirbus, or if they're going to a surgeon for this? Does it not imply that?
If the surgeon always deals with these kind of cases, I don't think so. It is kirabasa, but it's not derechiva. The only prohibition of kirabasa is derechiva. If a couple that's married and the wife didn't go to mikveh, then we have mochumris. But for someone treating an eshesish, like you say, someone treating someone else, whenever this kirabasa is not derechiva, it's permissible. So a doctor, lechatchila, is preferable to have male doctors treat male, female treat female. If the best one in the field is from the opposite gender, or the best one in the neighborhood, but I don't want to travel to Boston. Best one in the neighborhood is the opposite gender. So then we assume that he probably will not have hair hurim. He deals with this all the time.
Well, so maybe we'll do your third case now.
Okay.
So we still have a little bit of time left, but I want to make sure we get through the third case, and then we'll open up for questions at the end.
Okay. So in the third case, in a way, it's a little bit of a repetition, and some topics we already touched upon. And as I said before, I wasn't expecting the Rabbi Sheff to be so kind to us. So that does make it easier.
Keep saying you're kind.
From the halachic standpoint, comes a question here, then I want to present this case. A 55-year-old come to me, and she's complaining, you know, that people look at her and say, you look tired, and her upper eyelids, they droopy. You know, the skin is too droopy. She look at her friends, they don't look like that. She has some bags under her lower eyelids. And we discussed to do a rejuvenation of this area, what it involves, and I give her two options. If you just want to fix her upper eyelids, remove that excess skin, how is that done? It potentially could be done under local anesthesia in an office. We just inject that area. The skin is usually not very, very painful. She will have a scar, but the scar usually falls on the groove of the, you know, of the upper eyelid, so it gets very concealed. It's usually an area that heals very, very well. And we'll give her, you know, certainly one of the procedures that for the least amount of operation, she has the most amount of gain or change in her appearance. When it comes to the bags under the eyelids, it's a little different. It's an area that it's extremely sensitive to get to that area. So most people cannot tolerate just have it done under local anesthesia. So they need some sort of sedation, intravenous sedation. So it's safer, preferable that we do this in an operating room, or at least if we do in the office, have an anesthesiologist present. So we're talking already, a little more involved procedure. So I give it those two options. You want to have your entire, eyelid rejuvenated. We will need to do this in an operating room with anesthesia, at least sedation. If you just want to have your upper eyelids, that could be done in the office under local anesthesia. So those are the two options in front of her. And the next thing she's probably going to come to Rabbi Glatz to ask, what do I do? So I leave to you to comment on that.
I would assume was winziger, whatever, if she'll be satisfied with doing the lesser surgery. So there's no need to do the extra. If she would be happy without any surgery, we would leave it the way it is. But I mean, the woman feels bad. The person feels bad that she doesn't look good. So if doing less will satisfy her, so you should try that. And if she's still not happy, she still feels bad about herself, then it would be permissible to do the rest also. Same guidelines as before?
We're discussing predominantly cosmetic enhancement here. Is there lesser of a Shiloh if we're talking something where there's an improvement in function? A patient will come to my, I practice oral and maxillofacial surgery. A patient comes to my office, they've been wearing a full denture for the last 15 years, a 65-year-old male, he's fine with it, but he would like to improve his chewing and perhaps his appearance, but he certainly has to improve his chewing. It's going to require two maxillary sinus lifts, he's raising the entire maxillary sinus, placing 8 endosteal implants. These are implants that go into the upper jaw. It's a much more invasive procedure, something Marty might have called a mega case. It's a much more invasive procedure. Could he survive with the denture? Yeah, he'll go on with his life with the denture. But here it's going to improve his function. Is there a lesser of a Shiloh? Do I even have to consider it at that point? We're talking more function here than cosmesis.
That's regular surgery, so that's permissible, not only to save one's life, to improve the function of the body. It's permissible, unless there's a risk. How much of a risk is there and how not?
Again, there's always risk. There's the risk of infection, as we said, and nerve damage and so forth. It's minimal. But here I'm improving someone's function. So I'm just saying, is there lesser of a, or is it this fall within the same halachic parameters, the cosmetic enhancement versus functional?
Functional is more svara that is mutter, more permissible than cosmetic, certainly. By definition, that's not called chavola. Tikkun aguf is not called chavola.
At this point, I haven't really given Rav Schachter a chance to talk about any subjects before we go into the question and answer period of time. So I'll give the opportunity to Rav Schachter now to talk about any other subjects in this area that we didn't discuss. Some specific things that I'd wanted the Rav to talk about was, for example, eye surgery, LASIK surgery, laser surgery on the eye. Are there any halachic concerns about that, the advantage being that a person won't have to wear glasses? Does that pose any problem? I asked Rav Schachter to also talk about hair transplantation. Is there an issur in undergoing chavala for a man usually to put in plugs, to put in hair in places where it no longer is growing. And as well, I asked Rav Schachter to discuss the whole general field, which has come up a little bit already. Are there any halachic concerns for a person going through a residency in plastic surgery? What halachic issues does that bring up? So, and any other issues that Rav Schachter would like to talk about?
The laser surgery for the eye, if it, what, it improves the eyesight or it improves the good looks of the eye, is permissible.
The vision, okay. Purely vision.
Why not? That's permissible. Even though he can wear glasses, but he doesn't want to wear glasses. Normal is to see with your eyes, not to see with glasses. Just because we're used to everybody wearing glasses, I would think it's certainly permissible. The hair transplant, a person lost his hair, and a man would rather walk, let's say a man is bald, and he feels uncomfortable about the fact that he looks bald. The normal people have, normally people have hair. I don't think that's an iser of Leil Bash Gever, that a man is not allowed to dress up like a woman. Normally men have hair. So if the fellow feels bad, he's allowed to have hair implanted. A shayla, is it a chatzitza when he puts on the tefillin? So if he just glues on a toupee, so then, yeah, then it's a chatzitza. It didn't blend in to become part of the body. But if they did surgery and it's really hair that's growing, is it really hair? Hair is growing for them? So then it's not going to be considered a chatzitza. I don't know. Someone said, I don't think it's correct, someone said the name of Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, that if you glue on a toupee onto the head, since it's a miut, shena makbid, so it's not a chatzitza. Miut shena makbid is when a person goes to the mikveh. So the whole surface of the body has to be submerged under the water, has to touch the water. So the part that you have the toupee glued on, he wants it there, so that's a mere chain of makbid. But when you're wearing tefillin, the tefillin is only on the toupee. That's the whole thing. The chatzitz on the whole thing, that's not a miut. That's a chatzitz on the whole tefillin. So I would think that that is a chatzitz. But if it's not a toupee, if they have a hair implant and it's attached to the body, so then I would think it's not a prohibition of Leil Bash Gever. Normally men have hair, so if he feels bad over the loss of the hair, he wants to implant the hair, I think it's permissible. And then it wouldn't be a chatzitza either. What's the issue with the residency? Residence people always on the Chal Shabbos?
No, in terms of specifically for plastic surgery, if you're asked to participate in procedures that would not be meeting the halachic standard, what should the approach be?
Procedure just for the sake of vanity.
You're learning, you're training in a program, they're doing all sorts of procedures.
Yeah, I don't know. You raised the question whether this prohibition of Chavala Osel Adam Lachbol Biatzma, does it apply to a non-Jew? A Jew is not allowed to beat up a non-Jew, that's for sure. But what if the non-Jew wants to? The non-Jew wants to go into the circus, he wants to be the man with the four fingers on both hands. Is he permitted to cut off a finger? I don't know, maybe it's permissible.
Transgender
for non-Jews is also prohibited. Sirus, yeah. The Talmud says the Rambam Paskin Sirus for non-Jews is prohibited. Yeah. But the bichovel on the body, I don't know, maybe it's like tattooing. I think non-Jews are permitted to tattoo their body. I think a Jewish doctor would, Jewish tattooer, I don't know, doctors don't do it. I think a Jewish tattooer would probably be permitted to tattoo the body of a non-Jew. But to do, I think, I don't know, about chavola for a non-Jew, as I mentioned before, if it's because hanushamas lihen, if we assume the body belongs to God and we're not the balabatim to mutilate the body, so you're not allowed to mutilate the body of a non-Jew either. But I don't know, it could be that that's not the reason why it's prohibited. It could be it's only prohibited on a Jewish body, like shaving off the pace. So it could be it would be permissible. If it's prohibited to do such a procedure on a non-Jew, then it's not permissible for anyone to help out. If the doctor needs assistance, the doctor who's performing the surgery is violating an avera, then the one who's going to help him is helping out to do an avera. That's lifnei v'lisita michshol, so that you're not allowed to do. Let's say the doctor's performing an abortion when there's no heter, and the doctor only has two hands, and he needs someone to help him out. So whichever nurses or whatever doctors help him out to perform an abortion that's not permissible are in violation of lifnei iver. You would have to determine whether the surgery is permissible or not on a non-Jew. I don't know.
Are there any other points the Rav would like to bring up before I open it up to questions?
We'll open up the questions. We'll hear some more points. Okay.
Can the Rav comment on occasionally women will experience some hair thinning as a result of wearing a shaitel, which can functionally happen, and it does bother them. Is there any sort of a heter, or what sort of instructions or guidance can be done in that particular case with regard to if there's a heter not to wear the shaitel because of the hair thinning or hair loss?
I mean, they should wear a techel. They should wear a hat instead.
I think that would also might
be also pose the problem.
It could just from the pressure from the inclusion of the usage of the.
Unless he wears something loose, so loose techel, something
what
loose.
What sort of ramification or option would be available? So saying they should still cover their hair.
I would think so. Someone told me about a case of a woman who kept on getting headaches, and she was physically sick from covering her hair, period. Does that correspond to reality? There isn't such a thing. A dentist was telling me that he was treating a female patient, a religious woman, and she was telling him as he was doing the work that she has this problem even when she wears a hat. It causes her to be nauseous, and she doesn't feel well all day long. That's a serious problem. I don't know. That's a serious problem.
It might be allergies.
Uh-huh.
It might be allergies.
Well, assuming that the in fact that it is true, I certainly have had women ask me that, Shaila. In terms of it definitely causing headaches or definitely causing a significant amount of discomfort.
Mm-hmm.
What are the halachic options in that respect, assuming that there is no potential hair covering that would be halachically acceptable?
Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva where he points out that there seem to be two opinions in Rashi on the Gemara and Ksubis regarding the married women covering the hair. Whether we consider this a mitzvah or we consider it something more severe, is it an avera? It's an avera for a married woman not to cover her hair. So what's the difference whether it's a mitzvah or an avera? So if it's only a mitzvah, so there's a limit how far you have to go to fulfill a mitzvah. If observing a mitzvah is going to cause me to get sick, then I'm not mechuyav to fulfill a mitzvah. If it's going to... You're not mechuyav, ha-mevazuz, ha-yevazuz, yesi mechaymish. You're not permitted to spend more than 1/5 of your total savings to perform a mitzvah. You're not mechuyav to get sick. But if it's an avera, then you're not permitted to violate the avera unless you have a real safek sakana. So Rabbi Moshe Feinstein has a famous tshuva where he says, he's talking about a woman who is divorced. So his opinion was that a woman who is divorced is only obligated to cover her hair midirabbanan. It's not a biblical din. So he says since it's only midirabbanan, and by covering her hair, she said she's going to continue covering her hair, so she's going to have great difficulty finding a shidduch. She may not find a shidduch, so he's mekel. The woman who's divorced doesn't have to cover hair because that's considered too difficult to cover hair. If the woman is still married, then it's a sveika deraisa. If the woman is divorced, it's a sveika derabbanan. It's interesting. Rabbi Reuven Aberman, who used to teach in yeshiva, he now lives in Eretz Yisrael, taught Michal Alav for many years. So he told us that on two occasions before the Iron Curtain fell down, so he and a friend of his went to Russia to visit the different locations and to give shiurim there. So, and they gave him exactly, you go to this address and you give a shiur, we're up to learning Mishnahis and we're up to this Mishnah. You go to that address, the learning Chumash, you give a shiur on this. And then he went to some location, there were 10, 11 people there, men and women together, you give a shiur on Ksuvah Stafayim Beis. So Ksuvah Stafayim Beis is the obligation of women to cover their hair. So he studies the Gemara with this small group, and the woman asks a question, what happens if she'll cover her hair and she'll lose her job? Because under the communists, if you demonstrate any religion, so they fire you. So he doesn't realize that it's a shayla halacha l'maisa. The woman is going to lose her job. So he says, oh, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva. They don't know who Rabbi Moshe Feinstein is. They never heard of him. So Rabbi Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva that if the woman is still married, it's a biblical requirement, and it's two opinions in Rashi, whether it's a mitzvah or an avera. And since it's a suffix deraisa, you go to chumash, she has to cover her, even if she's going to lose her job. If the woman is divorced, it's only midrabbanan, then it's a suffix derabbanan. He tells him a whole pilpul. Then he comes back 2 years later, same address, they're studying something else, and he sees this woman sitting in the back with her babushka. So he asks the people, what's the story with that woman? She's the one who asked last time whether she has to cover her hair. So she never heard of Rabbi Aberman. She never heard of Rabbi Moshe Feinstein. A man came and he taught her that if you're married, you have to cover your hair, even if it means you're going to lose your job. So she was the head of, how do you say, to deliver babies?
Midwife?
No, in the hospital.
Maternity nurse.
No, she was a doctor who delivers babies.
She was an obstetrician.
She was the chief obstetrician in the hospital there in Russia. So the next day, after she heard the shiur, she came in with a babushka. They fired her on the spot because she's observing the Jewish religion. But they retained her as a janitor in the hospital. In case there'll be a difficult delivery, she should be present in the room. She's not allowed to touch the patient because he's a janitor, but she'll tell the doctor what the doctor should do. So he was telling us this story. The woman never heard of me. She never heard of Rabbi Moshe Feinstein. And I told her the din, and she observed the din the very next day. And we live in America, and no one's losing any jobs. And we are lax on these dinim. I don't know, it's a problem. If a woman has a condition, if you can figure out what she's allergic to, so you have to solve the problem somehow. If you can't solve the problem, it's not a serious child. It could be that she doesn't have to cover her hair. It was going to cause her to get sick. If you hold, it's only a mitzvah. You know, maybe you're not mechuyev to get sick for covering your hair. I don't know. It's a serious shame.
Yes.
Two questions, almost for the sake of completeness. Can one perform any cosmetic procedure on a parent? That's number one. And number two, can on Shabbos, when it comes to suturing, when in a situation when one can one give a better cosmetic result if it means that you have to place more sutures?
Mm-hmm. On Shabbos, if you have a situation of a suffix hakone and you're allowed to be machal Shabbos, so then the Rambam, one of the commentaries on the side of the Rambam, the Magen Mishnah, writes, and this is quoted in the Shulchan Aruch, that you're permitted to be Michal Shabbos to take care of kol tzarachov, all the needs of the patient. And the simple reading is, even those needs of the patient that are not going to save his life. Once you do the job, you're permitted to be Michal Shabbos to do the whole job. So the Mishnah Brura is very unhappy about this. He has a long, long essay, and he thinks we should only permit Chilul Shabbos for kol tzarachov of the patient, to do everything that would normally be done on a weekday. He thinks you shouldn't allow this on biblical prohibitions, only on Yisurim Derabbanan. And it's well known that Rab Chaim Soloveitchik disagreed, and he answered all the kashas of the Mishnah Brura on this kasha, and he thought, Rab Velvel Soloveitchik, the son of Rab Chaim, quotes this in his Sefer on Hilchus Yom Kippur, and he thinks we should follow the Shulchan Aruch. That's a big machloikas. Rav Soloveitchik tells the story that when his father took the first Rabbanis, when he left his father, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, and he took a Rabbanis in Europe, so his father made him promise that he'll paskin like the family psak, like this was the psak in Volozhin, from Rav Chaim Volozhinov, from years before, that when there's a chayla on Shabbos, or on Yom Kippur, so you're allowed to violate Shabbos, you're allowed to violate Yom Kippur, not only to eat enough on Yom Kippur, to stay alive, you're allowed to eat as much as you would normally eat on a weekday. Most Rabbanim would not paskin like that. Most Rabbanim follow the Mishnah Brura, they should only eat a little bit and wait 10 minutes, then eat another little bit, wait 10 minutes. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik thought that was the psak in the yeshiva in Volozhin, from Rav Chaim Volozhinov, that once a person is a chodesh esh b'sakana, so you do whatever is necessary, you don't have to minimize. So that's a big machlokes. About treating one's parent, the Gemara says, in addition to the general prohibition against mutilating anyone else's body, the Gemara says there's a prohibition of maka of avim, if he causes bleeding by a parent. So it's a discussion in the Gemara whether a child is permitted to treat his parent. So if there's a life-threatening situation, and for the sake of pikuach nefesh, she has to save the parent's life, so of course it's permissible. We're not talking about that. What if it's not life-threatening? Would that be permissible? It's a dentist to treat a parent, or for cosmetic purposes. So the Gemara has two opinions, and the accepted opinion of Shulchan Aruch is that different opinions are we should paskin, accepted opinion of Shulchan Aruch is that if you can avoid it, if another doctor is available, you should really get someone else to do it. And if there's no one else available, then the son is permitted to treat the parent because the parent wants him to treat him. That's the question. What does it mean, there's no one else available? Literally, there's no one else available? Or let's say if there's no one else who will do it for nothing, the child would do it for nothing, and no one else would do it for nothing, then Ratzi Pesach Frank has a whole tshuva. He says the son is mechuyev to send his parent to another doctor, and son is mechuyev to pay. Son is mechuyev to pay. Because the son, biblically, the son is mechuyev to treat the parent. He's allowed to treat the parent. And he's mid the Rabbana, we don't permit him to treat the parent. We're afraid he's going to cut slightly more than is necessary. So the paying of the money is necessary on the part of the son that he shouldn't violate that there. So that's what Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank says. So many are of the opinion, let's say there are other doctors available, but the parents only, they're nervous, older people, they're nervous. They feel much more comfortable having their own child do the surgery, not because they're getting it for nothing. They're getting it for nothing, so the son is mechuyev to pay, have the parent go to some other doctor. But the parents are afraid to go to someone else. So many are of the opinion that that's also mutter. That's considered as if there's no other doctor to treat the parent. I think it would be the same by cosmetic surgery, the same hetta.
Yes.
Rob said earlier that a large consideration with this elective cosmetic surgery, let's say, is societal norms and also the patient's state of mind. It's an increased psychological issue. Do we apply this same halachic principles to other areas of halacha, for example, in sneers, if the societal norm is very different than the Jewish norm, and also if it makes a person's state of mind very bad, that he or she is not in sync with the non-Jewish or the outside influences of societal norm. Do you apply the same thing as well?
Sneers always is societal, but there has to be a limit. Let's say if you're... It says in Shulchan Aruch, we just read in yesterday's Parsha that the Metzora has to shave off all of his hair when he becomes Tahor. It says in the Shulchan Aruch, in Pasuk, he has to shave off his eyebrows. So the commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch are bothered with Akasha. If the married women have to cover their hair, why don't we require they should wear a tichel down over the eyebrows? Because the eyebrows are considered Seir, so Seir B'Yisha Erva. So the Magen Avraham quotes from the Maharam al Shakar, that since the minhag hamakom is that the women leave their eyebrows exposed, whatever the minhag hamakom is okay. It's societal. So what if the minhag hamakom, let's say it's a nudist colony, minhag hamakom is that people walk around without any clothes. So there's no din of erva, so you have to draw a limit somewhere. So somebody has to draw a limit. So the chayyadim drew some limits, or Moshe Feinstein drew some limits. You have to have some limits. Whatever is acceptable within those limits is acceptable. If a person feels uncomfortable overdressing, and it's within those guidelines, so then you can dress according to the society. And past those limits, we don't allow. Okay.
So what are the limits in elective cosmetic surgery? What are those minimum bare limits? If, for example, the societal norm is to change everything, wrists, fingers, arms, upper arms, lower arms, neck, chin, what would be the the minimum limits that we have?
We assume that God created a beautiful body, so the body the way it is fine. There's nothing wrong. If something is abnormal, so we want to fix it. So the bags under the eyes and so on. Or even though there's nothing wrong, the women want to put on earrings. Okay, so you make you pierce the ears. I don't know. I guess as society will do more and more mishigasim, so the rabbanim will have to determine what's reasonable and what's unreasonable. Do you have any specific example that you...
No, but I mean, by the way, that case you just mentioned again is one of those we talked about before. If someone comes to me and wants their eyes, their face, their arms, their wrists, their legs, bye-bye. And I mean, that's basically what happens. I mean, that's a particular case. You know, there's a syndrome called BDD, which is body dysmorphism disease. Which is, we deal in our specialty, I'm sure you've heard of it, where people have this illogical concept that they just never look good, and they're constantly coming to plastic surgeons to change this and change that and change this and change that, and we have to recognize that these are people that have another problem other than the cosmetic problem, and that's what you're basically saying. If someone's coming to me about every other part of their body, it's probably not appropriate for the surgeon, whether from surgeon, Orthodox, Jewish, plastic surgeon, doesn't matter, it's not appropriate to do surgery on that patient.
Right, the time is 12 o'clock, so we said we would stop at this point. I want to thank everybody for taking 2 hours out of their time to spend time learning Torah. I would say Baruch Hashem, this was entire discussion was Lahagdil Torah Lahadira, because Baruch Hashem, I don't see a single person in this room that needs plastic surgery. So B'ezras Hashem, we should continue that way. Admeya V'esrim, and thank you all for coming. We thank especially Rav Herschel Shech, the Shlita, for coming from far away to address this morning. And we, of course, thank Drs. Kessler and Scheinman for their expertise and giving up their time this morning. Thank you all for coming.
And of course, special thanks. Of course, thank you for moderating. Fantastic.
And special thanks to the students, Bioethics Society, Yeshiva University, for putting this all together. Thank you very much.
Just a public service announcement. If you want to hear the shiur, it will be posted on yetar.org or ymedicalethics.com.
Middle button. You press it. Save.
I don't know what I pressed.